Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to new and returning listeners. I am Danica Ramsey-Brimberg and your host of this episode of New Books in Irish Studies under New Books Network. For today's episode, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Boyle, author of the recently published History and Salvation in Medieval Ireland. Welcome, Lizzie, to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Could you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Lizzie. I am lecturer in early Irish in Maynooth University in Ireland, and I've been there since 2013. I teach the kind of language, literature, and culture of Ireland from our earliest records up until the arrival of the Normans in the 12th century. Before that, I was at Cambridge University, where I did my postgraduate study and a couple of postdocs, and I did my undergraduate degree at Glasgow in Scotland.
Really interesting. So, and then those unfamiliar with your book, what is History and Salvation in Medieval Ireland about?
Well, it's about trying to understand how people in medieval Ireland, or more particularly the literate elites for whom we have evidence, how they saw themselves in relation to world history as they perceived it, where they understood Ireland to exist in sort of chronological terms, and where the arrival of Christianity and conversion to Christianity in Ireland's history, where it took its place within the broader scheme of salvation history. And so I look at sources that tell us about how people in medieval Ireland were studying history themselves, how they understood the past, how they drew on the Bible and classical authorities like Orosius and Augustine and Eusebius to kind of construct their own understanding of global history and to find strategies of placing Ireland within that broader scheme. So the book mostly focuses on sources that were written in the 10th through to the 12th centuries, which we call the Middle Irish period. And because it was an area that was relatively unstudied, I had a chance to offer some new editions and translations of primary sources that hadn't been published before, and those are included in the book too.
Ooh. So, and then was it that people not talking about it? Is that what inspired you to write the book?
Not originally. The original inspiration from the book actually came from my teaching. When I was appointed to my job in Maynooth in 2013, I was asked to teach a very vague module that had been set up in the knowledge that somebody new would be joining the department, but without them knowing what that person's area of expertise would be. And in the end, it was me who was appointed. And this module was called Treasures of Irish Literature, and there was sort of no definition of what those treasures might be. So I decided that what I would do is, rather than looking at some of the more predictable maybe sources that the students might already be looking at with their other lecturers, instead I would look at some treasures that had never previously been translated before or hadn't been discussed in scholarship before. So I began translating these 10th century sources for use in the class and just discussion in the class. And some of them were about King David and his sons, Absalom and Solomon. Some of them were about the Psalms and the power of the Psalms in the early Irish church. And the more of them that I translated, the more I realized that there was a book's worth of material there within these sources that hadn't really been incorporated in scholarly conversation before. So the idea from the book really came from that module, really the enthusiasm that the students had for this interesting material that they'd never seen before.
I really wish I could have taken a class like that. So then for the listeners, why is it important that we focus on medieval concepts of salvation and its relation to power and history, particularly in this period?
Well, for me, coming from an Irish context, it's important to understand Ireland's conception of itself within the context of the wider world. I think in scholarship, particularly in the 20th century, people working in Irish studies were very, very focused on what they perceived as so-called native tradition, so-called allegedly indigenous traditions. And so there was a lot of historiographical focus on Irish material to the exclusion of the fact that people in Ireland in the Middle Ages were very interested in the world around them. And in the first sort of decades of the 21st century, there was a kind of opening out, I think, really. A lot of scholars started looking at, for example, Ireland's indebtedness to classical culture and classical learning. So there's, you know, great scholars working on the concept of grammatica or the influence of Isidore, the influence of Greek and Latin literature and narrative literature on Irish sources. And that began to, I think, open things out a little bit, show that Ireland in the Middle Ages was outward looking and not simply sort of insular and peculiar. And I hope that my contribution is just sort of widening it out further still to look at how Ireland saw itself in relation to, for example, the history of the Jewish people, the history of the Assyrian empires, the Persian Empire. So looking one step maybe beyond the classical world and into to the world sort of further afield. And I hope that it's part of a broader process of opening out medieval Irish studies to see it within a more global context. And when we start to do that, I think that we see that people in medieval Ireland were thinking about history in the same way as their neighbours in other cultures on the European continent and in Britain, for example.
So thinking of then these connections both within Ireland and with the wider world, then why was it, with Ireland having its own unique history akin to other places, then why was it so important to reinvent then the narrative of Ireland, which seems to be, at least you mentioned the historiography, people are doing that. Why was it then, why was it occurring, I guess, so why was this so important in the early medieval world?
I think partly it was to do with the fact that when Christians in Ireland in the early Middle Ages looked to their holy book and their authoritative texts, they didn't see themselves in them. Ireland isn't mentioned as one of the sort of nations of the Bible. It's the Irish people are not mentioned as one of the big biblical peoples, and you know there's a very passing reference to Ireland in Orosius, but you know Ireland isn't mentioned in many of the great sort of patristic authors and so on. So to me, as my understanding of the sources is that they sort of are an attempt in a way to locate Ireland within a broader narrative and find a place for Ireland within that broader narrative, to write Ireland into salvation history and to connect Irish culture back with the culture of their authoritative books and authoritative sources. And that happens in a whole variety of ways, far beyond anything that I could even explore in the book. So, I mean, you could write a whole book in itself on the way that that's done in genealogies, for example, which was something that I didn't really get to cover in the book, but the way that sort of royal dynasties are writing themselves back into a biblical genealogy and so on. It just is happening across so many different elements of the intellectual world in medieval Ireland. And it's part of, I think, an all-encompassing project to try to find Ireland's place within the scheme of history. And so I just took the opportunity to look at the range of sources that I did, which were mostly sort of historical verse and biblical adaptations and short narratives about biblical characters and so on.
In your response, you say you use the phrase salvation history, which is a critical part of the book. What does that mean?
So to me, salvation history was the fundamental Christian conception of history in the Middle Ages. So if you look to the Bible and the kind of chronology that's offered there from creation through to the apocalypse, that gives you the kind of scheme of broad Christian history. And the idea of salvation history is that God is active within that history. Like it says in the Psalms, that God has wrought salvation in the midst of the earth, and that is the kind of concept underlying salvation history. And so it's an overarching conception of history that has a beginning with the creation. It has a pivotal turning point with the incarnation of Christ, the crucifixion and the resurrection. And then it has an end point, which is the eschatological kind of side of things. And within that overarching scheme, the idea that sort of God's hand is present in history is manifested in, for example, the rise and fall of empires, and the idea of translatio imperii, the movement of sort of global dominance from east through to west. So that at the time when these sources are being written, the perception is that Rome and the Church of Rome is this sort of dominant seat of power. In global terms, it's a very specifically Christian view of the world, and specifically medieval view of the world. But there is so much evidence for it being fundamental to the way that people in Ireland understood their place in history, the moment that they were living in history. And so I think it's very fundamental to understanding their own worldview, to understand them and how they saw themselves within history.
Were these ideas then universal throughout the literature or the early medieval Irish world? As far as we know, I know the evidence from the early medieval period can be limited.
Yeah, it does. It seems to be a continuous thread from our earliest sources surviving from Ireland, both in Latin and in the vernacular. There are changes in emphases over time. So one of the key arguments I think that I made in one of the chapters of the book is that in the 11th and 12th centuries, we start to suddenly see a more of a concern in medieval Irish sources with thinking about empire, with thinking about sort of imperial imagery and the history of empires in the world. That seems to be something that emerges only really in the 11th century. Before that, the emphasis tends to have been more on kingship, I suggest, and particularly the kingship of Israel and the frequent use of King David as a kind of archetype of good kingship, but also Solomon, his son as well, the importance of figures like that. So I argue that there is a shift from an emphasis on kingship into an emphasis on empire, but that doesn't change the fundamental framework, which does seem to be this overarching scheme of salvation history, which appears in my view to be a constant from the earliest sources in the 7th century through to the latest ones that I look at in the book, which are from the late 12th century.
So thinking about that continuation, in the book you discuss certain parallels between Irish and Hebrew figures. Was that done for similar reasons?
Well, that's actually a very big question in a way, because you get a lot of different ways in which parallels are drawn between Irish figures and Hebrew figures in early Irish sources. So you get, for example, just sort of straightforward, maybe sort of typological connections. I give an example in the book where King David is characterized very deliberately, I think, to be reminiscent of the Irish character Cuchulainn, and Cuchulainn is altered and made to resemble King David, to draw sort of connections between the two. But there's also something more, a different phenomenon going on, specifically with regard to St. Patrick, who is, you know, very in an extensive number of sources, he's very deliberately characterized as a kind of Moses figure. I discuss in the book some of the ways in which that's the case, the way that Patrick is reshaped to be characterized as a person who brings law to his people in the same way that Moses brought the commandments to the Jewish people. You then start to get other kind of similarities drawn between Patrick and Moses. In the hagiography about Patrick, he becomes increasingly Moses-like, to the point where the most sort of, I suppose, developed example of that I discuss in the book is a note that we find in a couple of places where it's claimed that Patrick was himself descended from Jewish stock. And the note claims that Patrick's ancestors had arrived in Britain as a result of the persecution under Vespasian. And it was because, according to this note, it was because of Patrick's descent from the children of Israel that he was able to bring the power of baptism and faith to Ireland. So that sort of a fabrication of a Jewish ancestry for Patrick is sort of the most highly developed end of the spectrum, but the entire spectrum involves reshaping Patrick along increasingly sort of Moses-like lines or you know, increasingly like a Moses-like figure. The drawing of parallels between medieval Ireland and ancient Israel is really multifaceted, and it finds its expression in a whole range of different sources. And as I note briefly in the book, it's also a very real phenomenon visible in early Irish law, because early Irish law is itself heavily indebted to Levitical law and to biblical law more generally. So it's both a creative thing in terms of the literary depictions of people like Cuchulainn or St. Patrick, but it's also clearly a social or structural in preference in a way for the Old Testament over the New, which is reflective of the very real influence that Levitical law has on the development of early Irish law in the Middle Ages. So I'd say it's a big question, because it's something that finds expression in a whole kind of multitude of different ways.
Thinking of these and these parallels between these figures, well, I'm sure the audience is familiar with the traditional definition of translation. Could you please elaborate more on translation as a cultural transfer?
Yeah, okay. So there's lots of nice examples in the sources that I'm talking about. For example, in chapter 2, which is the chapter where I talk about these narratives about David and Absalom and Solomon. These are stories that are indebted to a greater or lesser degree to biblical narrative. If we take sort of, for example, the narratives that talk about the relationship between David and Absalom, the broad outline of Absalom rebelling against his father and the subsequent death of Absalom, who famously gets his hair gets caught in a tree, and he's sort of hanging there, stuck in the tree, his hair entangled in the branches. That's all there in the biblical account, which in medieval Ireland people would have read in Latin translation, and if the stories were straightforward translations in the sort of traditional sense that we understand translation to move something from one language into another, then the story we would expect to stick very closely to the biblical narrative, and that would be a simple translation. But rather what I suggest is going on with these sources is translation, as you say, as a kind of cultural transfer. So we get little details where the author writes that David issues instructions to his son, Absalom, but he writes these instructions in Ogham, we're told, which is the native Irish alphabet, the Irish script that's used for kind of monumental it's a bit like runic script, if you're not familiar with Ogham. And you get other instances where David is characterized as kind of almost like, he's rather than being as a young man the shepherd with his crook, he's more like Cuchulain with his hurling stick, and so you get these things that are very Irish culturally, the imagery, the use of the idea of them using Ogham, the idea of them being like young Irish warrior men, whatever. That's translation as cultural transfer, which is what's going on in these texts, so that they're not just being translated from Latin into the Irish language, but they're being translated into an Irish cultural milieu where people write in Ogham and they play hurling and they adhere to these sort of medieval Irish cultural norms.
In your book, I loved reading about the interweaving and about the influences that of both the Old Testament onto Irish figures and then elements of Irish culture being interwoven into the biblical passages as well. With such an emphasis on particularly on figures as well as elements from the Old Testament, why do you think that the Old Testament was such more a powerful force than, say, the New Testament?
That's a difficult question, and it's one that I don't know that there's necessarily an easily available answer for. So I'm far from the first person to observe for example, the legal indebtedness of Ireland to Levitical law, in terms of both law and liturgy. As early as the 1960s, scholars had commented on what they perceived as a preference for the Old Testament in early medieval Ireland over the New. I think it's possible to overstate that. There are quite a lot of sources pertaining to the New Testament in Ireland that still haven't been edited and translated. So it's possible that picture might adjust somewhat anyway. But it seems to me that the fact that, as the historian Donacha O'Corrine argued in the 1980s, that the early Irish clerical elite, the educated church elite, he suggested, had modelled themselves on the Levitical class. And so, if we accept his characterization of that, then maybe it sort of grows from there that, other aspects of society would also be drawn from Old Testament models. That's certainly one possibility. It may be that it was simply easier to identify with the kind of sort of pastoral agrarian societies of the Old Testament, perhaps, in terms of self-identification, as opposed to what might have been perceived as a more sort of Romanized, urban, elite sort of type of early Christianity. Perhaps because Ireland was never part of the Roman Empire, it was influenced by Rome, but never part of Rome. So perhaps just the fact that of the lack of urban centres, the lack of kind of Romanized bureaucracy and so on, may just have made the Old Testament societies seem somehow more sort of applicable to early Irish society. But as I say, it's a difficult question that I don't think we're at the stage of being able to answer yet. And as I say, it may be the case that further study of other sources might balance out that perceived weight towards the Old Testament and show that the New Testament was equally important, perhaps.
Within your answer, you talk about how Ireland was an agrarian society. With a lot of these studies, these stories, they were written by and for a literate audience. So was it just, were these stories available to other individuals at all or any form, do you think? Or is it just, say, the elite situated within this salvation history?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, clearly the sources that I discuss in the book were written at ecclesiastical centres. Some of those ecclesiastical centres were fairly substantial, very large centres, but they weren't urban in any meaningful sense. So how do these sources then get sort of communicated to broader audiences? And the fact that they're being written in Irish as opposed to Latin would suggest that they are perhaps intended for a broader audience, including a lay audience. One of the things that is worth noting is that by the time most of the sources that I discuss are being written, so in the 11th, 12th centuries, we are starting to get the development of towns in Ireland, thanks to the Scandinavian settlers who established Ireland's urban centres like Dublin, Waterford, Limerick, and so on. But one of the key areas that I suspect might have been a way of sort of identifying the potential audience for some of these texts is what I sort of tentatively argue or sort of raise as a possibility in the book is that some of them might have been intended for the purposes of educating royal young men or aristocratic young men, because some of the narratives, especially those sort of about David and Solomon and Absalom, you know, they seem to contain lessons for kings. Some of the narratives that I discuss in chapter three, which are sort of seemingly, I think, pedagogical narratives, they have, again, sort of lessons for kings. So as I say, there's not enough evidence to be certain, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that some of them might have been written for aristocratic young men as part of their education, part of their formation, what is expected of young royal men. And they may have been among the secular audience for such narratives beyond the immediate sphere of the ecclesiastical centres in which they were clearly written.
Which, it's thinking about these in the audience who was reading them, were these then texts ever affected by the current events going on, whether from the beginning of them being written to the, because you've got the Viking Age settlement and rulership going on, as well as sort of towards the tail end of the text you talk about, we sort of see the beginning of events like the Crusades. So were these power and religious struggles ever influential in these texts, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, because the nature of the sources, the kinds of things being written, it changes over time. And I think they are being influenced by both what's happening on the ground within Ireland itself and also what's happening further afield. So, for example, I discuss a little bit about what appears to be an increasing interest in urban centres in these kinds of biblical sources at the same time as Ireland is developing urban centres itself. So you suddenly get these much more extended writings about the city of Babylon, for example, and Babylon's architecture and its inhabitants and its buildings and its history. And that seems to emerge into the sources at the same time that Ireland's own first cities like Dublin are developing and growing. So it does seem that what's happening on the ground is shaping the kinds of sources that are being produced. They do seem to be responding to current events. And I wonder, even if the increased interest in the idea of the movement of imperial power and the history of, as I say, both sort of the Babylonian and Persian empires and so on, whether that is in some way influenced also by what's going on in the beginning of the sort of crusading era and so on. There are other sources that I don't talk about at all in the book, but where people have certainly inferred an influence from crusading literature, from the fashions for Arthurian literature, for example. Those things are clearly having an influence on Irish vernacular composition at the time. So we shouldn't be surprised that it's also having an influence on these sort of more learned and historical texts that are being composed at the same time as well.
That also leads me to my next question, which is, were the texts ever altered to make them more relevant to a current audience, or is there perhaps more going on?
Some of the ones that I look at, they are certainly altered. We have oftentimes multiple versions of what's clearly the same text, but it's being changed over time. In the examples that I look at, the changes are more sort of pedagogical in a way. So I have one narrative about David and Solomon that's very clearly intended in the earliest version in which it survives to be a kind of legal precedent. So it's a story about David and Solomon, but it establishes the principle of why in early Irish law inheritance should be divided three ways between the lord, the kin, and the church. So clearly, and that's the earliest version in which it survives, a 10th century version, and it seems to function as a sort of etiological story for this legal precedent or legal principle. But then we have another version from a couple of centuries later where it's still the same sort of story and the same scenario, except rather than exemplifying the legal principle, which isn't really mentioned at all, instead it becomes actually about the power of miracles and about the power of blessings to confer miraculous consequences. So clearly the legal pedagogical purpose has disappeared, and it's become a more sort of edifying or devotional kind of story. And that change must have something to do with intended audience, function, who is intended to be reading or hearing this story. But it's quite a dramatic change in function of the story. So we see these kinds of changes all of the time that clearly are responding to immediate pragmatic considerations, like what the story is being used for, what the narrative is being used for, and who its audience is.
And understanding these audiences, you discuss early on in the book, and so we're circling back to the beginning again, is that early Irish writers are portraying Ireland as the next chosen people, but the relationship with Judaism is actually, if you reading the book, it was really interesting. It sounds far more complex. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was focusing on sources that, if you were to read them in isolation, would seem to have an exceptionally favorable or exceptionally positive view towards Jewish history, Jewish culture, and this idea that the Irish people are in some way modeling aspects of their society on the accounts of the Jewish people in the Pentateuch, for example. What I wanted to do, for example, at the beginning of chapter one was just to show that it is more complex than that, and that it's not a sort of simple or straightforward favorable view of Judaism as a whole. Rather, it's laden with, first of all, some quite sort of sadly predictable sort of anti-Judaic rhetoric that's quite common to Christian texts from the time. So this idea that the Jewish people have forfeited they may have been God's chosen people, but they have forfeited that position through the crucifixion of Christ, and that therefore the Irish can take up that mantle. So as I say, that's a kind of formulaic anti-Judaism. But even beyond that, there were a few instances that I drew attention to where we have very overt anti-Semitism, and that there's poetry being composed. I give the example of a poet in the 8th century, Blathwack, son of Coubreton, who really writes quite offensive verse about the Jewish people as being a lesser people. It's, as I say, it goes into outright anti-Semitism. And so I think it's important to be aware of that context before I discuss the sources that are more favorable or positively disposed to emulating aspects of Jewish history, to see that it's not a straightforward picture. There's a complex relationship, some of the problematic rhetoric and even, you know, outright offensive hostility that we unfortunately encounter in other European literatures from the Middle Ages as well, that those things are there in the Irish texts too. And so therefore, yeah, the situation is more complex than simply being unusually predisposed to celebrate and emulate Jewish history and culture.
It sounds very, yeah, with all the different aspects going on, and both it's both an appreciation, but there's also very negative portrayals within the text as well. So you have this, it's an interesting combination going on there. So in the acknowledgments, you mentioned that you finished... Sorry,
I was just going to say that it's just made all the more sort of peculiar in a way by the lack of any Jewish communities that we know about in Ireland in the early Middle Ages. As far as we can tell, there were no Jewish communities in Ireland until the arrival of the English invasion in the late 12th century. And we have one record of a Jewish embassy arriving at the court of a king in the south of Ireland, Murchtach O'Brien, and the annals record the arrival of this group of Jewish emissaries, but we're told that they were immediately sent back across the sea again, which suggests a real rebuffal of whatever advances they might have been making to the king and his court. And so this real, you know, all of this, both the positive and the negative, this whole discourse on Jewish history and culture is taking place in a total absence of real Jewish people and communities in Ireland, which is strange, I think.
It sounds strange to me as well. In the acknowledgments, you mentioned that you finished writing the book during the ongoing pandemic. What was it like to finish writing a book during this time?
Difficult. Wouldn't recommend it. I was homeschooling my daughter at the time. She's a teenager and she's getting stressed about exams. I didn't have any access to a library. It was a bit of a nightmare, but I was fortunate in the sense that I was already in kind of fairly advanced stages. Like I had all my research done, really. I'd been working on this project for quite a few years. And I was at a point where I could just let go of certain things and say, right, okay, I can't get to a library. I can't follow up on this, that's just going to have to go. And I just concentrated instead on getting it done as best as I could. I was also in the very sort of immediate aftermath of my dad dying. And I had sort of, you know, gone through kind of years and years of him sort of saying, oh, how's the book going? How's the book going? And I was, you know, there was always something else that had to be done and the book wasn't making progress. And when he died in January last year, I was just sort of so disappointed with myself at not having finished it so that he could see it, that I just thought, right, damn it, I'm gonna finish this book. And so I did, in sort of bizarre and chaotic circumstances. And I hope that people don't have to continue writing books without access to libraries and other facilities to get the work done. But it got done, and that was the important thing for me.
And I'm sure that he is very proud of what you did. It's an incredible book. What is the one thing that you hope readers take away from reading your book?
I hope people would take away from it the fact that Ireland in the Middle Ages was not some sort of peculiar outpost in the sort of far corner of Europe, but rather that there was a really active intellectual culture that was interested in the world around them. They were interested in what was happening, you know, in Babylon 3,000 years earlier. They were interested in what was happening in Jerusalem 1,000 years before they were writing. They were interested in the world. And although their sources of information may have been limited to the Bible and to patristic authorities and to very rarely more recent sort of testimony, they managed with that limited information to really develop a sophisticated conception of the rest of the world. They were thinking about the rest of the world to the best of the knowledge that was available to them at the time. And I think that's what I would hope that people would take away from the book.
And then do you have any future products, any future projects or anything else that you'd like to mention on the podcast?
Well, my next book is coming out in March. It's something completely different. I was approached by Penguin Ireland to write a volume of essays that combine kind of memoir and personal life writing with medieval, mostly Irish history, with a little bit of medieval Wales and England and a little bit of Francia thrown in as well. So it's something completely different. The title is Fierce Appetites, Lessons from My Year of Untamed Thinking. And as I say, it's an attempt to marry my own kind of life experiences with the subject matter that I study. So nervously throwing out my first non-academic book there in March.
Well, I'm excited to read that one as well. Thank you so much, Lizzie, for joining me today to talk about your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Elizabeth Boyle's book, History and Salvation in Medieval Ireland, is available now through Routledge as a part of their series Studies in Early Medieval Britain and Ireland. Her book, Fierce Appetites, My Year of Untamed Thinking, will be published next year by Penguin Books. If you'd like to hear more episodes, subscribe to New Books Network, New Books on Irish Studies on the New Books Network website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading. Thank you again for joining me.